Investors Chronicle.
Hello and welcome back to the IC Interviews. I'm Mary McDougall, and this week we're going to hear from both managers of a very interesting fund, Richard Watts and Nick Williamson of Chrysalis Investment Trust. Richard also manages Jupiter UK Midcap Fund, and they're both members of Jupiter's Small and Midcap UK Investment Team. Chrysalis launched in November 2018 and has seen tremendous growth, now boasting a market cap of around £1.4 billion. The trust invests in a concentrated portfolio of mainly unlisted high-growth companies, but its aim is to own them through flotation. As many companies are coming to market later, the idea is that they can capture growth early. Nick, Richard, thank you for joining me.
That's my name.
Now, as Chrysalis is quite an unusual trust, please can you kick off by explaining the thought process behind the fund and what type of companies you look to own? Richard, perhaps you could start us off.
Yeah, Mary, and I think the genesis of Chrysalis really goes back to 2017. On our small and mid-cap funds that we manage, we historically have been very active in the IPO market in the UK. If you think around, or historically anyway, around 99% of all IPOs in the UK come into the mid and small cap market. So it's very rare that a stock IPOs and goes straight into the FTSE 100. So as the largest desk in the mid and small cap market, we've been very active in that IPO space. And we were positioning ourselves as what we kind of call cornerstone investors. So we would take a large position in IPOs or companies that we liked at the point of IPO, effectively cornerstone in the IPO, de-risking the whole process. When you position yourself as a cornerstone investor, you are engaging with these companies 3, 6, 12, 18 months before an IPO, depending on the situation. And so by definition, those companies are still private businesses. And we were increasingly realizing that more and more of the companies that we were seeing had been staying private for longer. And that some that actually, we were meeting that were exploring their options around an IPO that subsequently were deciding to stay private. In the middle of 2017, so May 2017, I met a company called The Hut Group, now known as THG, and I met Matt Moulding. And that was really just to have a chat with Matt around his options, around an IPO. And it became clear really within 10 minutes of the meeting that an IPO was a number of years away. And I decided that actually I went back and I saw the team and I said, look, I think I found a very good investment for us, but it's private. And we decided to invest in the business whilst it was still private. And that was our first private investment. We then followed that up. So we made that investment in October 17. So it took a number of months to do the due diligence. We then invested in TransferWise. It was now called Wise Group, but TransferWise in November 17. And we realized that if we wanted to do more investing in private companies, given their illiquid nature, that we needed a more appropriate ownership vehicle. And that is basically where Chrysalis came from. So Nick and I test marketed Chrysalis in December 17, launched it, as you said, in November 2018. But the idea really was to say that if companies were choosing to stay private for longer, why could we not access these companies, whilst they were still private? And why wait for an IPO when a lot of the value that these companies were creating, that we were missing out on? So that was the idea of Chrysalis, really, was to create a vehicle that could allow our clients to capture the value that these fantastic, very fast-growing, innovative, disruptive companies were creating.
Yeah, it makes sense. It sounds like a similar approach to what Scottish Mortgage is doing in one portion of its fund. One problem can be access to these companies. They have the power to be quite picky on who their owners are. Have you had any difficulty accessing companies you want to own?
I think the way we kind of describe it really is that we are providing a differentiated type of capital. So, venture caps, if you think about who were the early backers of many of these private companies, seed investors, angel investors, and then venture capital. And typically those type of investors, they're looking for liquidity. They are sellers of these equities, certainly at the point of IPO. And as these companies are staying private for longer, that's a growing problem because, they need liquidity. They've got finite length of fund lives. And so companies are looking to evolve their shareholder registers, before an IPO. And there's a gap really for crossover investing. And you've seen this develop in the US, with the likes of Wellington and Legg Mason, FMR, BlackRock, etc. That's just a different, a differentiated type of capital that is able to support companies whilst they are private, but also across, you know, through the IPO and into the public market. So we are very much seen as one of the leaders in the IPO space in the UK. And because we've now built up a vehicle that's got real scale in the private space in Chrysalis. So, you know, the market cap of Chrysalis now is, you know, around £1.4 billion. So we've built up a real scale in that part of the market as well. So I think we are seen to be very attractive to a number of entrepreneurs. We're definitely viewed as long-term investors. You know, if you look at the listed funds that we manage or the open-ended funds that invest in listed equities, you know, many of the companies in our portfolios, we've been in there since the very early days, you know, post an IPO. So I think we are seen to be very attractive, really, for entrepreneurs seeking, you know, new investors on their shareholder registers. So I'd say in terms of access to investments, you know, I think we've got a very attractive portfolio. You know, names like Klarna, WeFox, obviously Wise Group, TSG, you know, Starling Bank, you know, they absolutely tick the box as being, I think, some of the most desirable private, you know, companies. Obviously, some of them have IPO'd now, but, you know, when we invested, they were private. Absolutely been seen as some of the most desirable private companies, not just in the UK, but, you know, pan-Euro and globally. So, yeah, I think we find that access is pretty easy for us.
I might just add to that, because I think the market has developed somewhat over the last few years, hasn't it, Richard? Because I think even when we started, I think there were a number of companies that we approached who kind of understood this whole idea of crossover, and they got the idea and they thought, well, actually, I can align myself with a natural buyer of listed equity. And of course, the wider desk runs sort of £7 billion in that place where most IPOs occur. They understood the rationale for joining up. You know, and I think over the course of the last few years, more and more companies have begun to understand the power of that crossover investing. So more and more people are looking for this type of money. So I expect this area of the market will continue to grow in importance. And I think that's really key, because to get into names like Klarna or TransferWise or Starling, you kind of have to turn up, and you can't just give them money, because there's lots of capital out there. The private market has got a lot of capital in it. What those guys are looking for, and girls, is a different type of money which they can used to help them develop the next stage of their business, and that might involve an IPO down the road. And so teaming up with somebody, you know, like us with Chrysalis and with wider desk products operating in different spaces like the listed market is very appealing.
I want to ask some specific questions about companies later, but before I do that, you raised around 300 million in March. Have you deployed all of that?
We've announced a number of investments since then. So we've announced an investment in Smart Pension. We've announced an investment in Revolution Beauty that we've done. We've announced an investment in Deep Instinct. So, you know, when you add all that up together, you know, we've spent a reasonable amount of that. In addition, we've also made follow-on investments in WeFox and in Starling. So if you did all those maths, I think I'm right in saying we probably spent around about half of it, maybe a little bit more. It's one of those things, you know, you raise the money and you have a pipeline, and it's a bit like buses. The pipeline might be very full, three come along at once, but equally having the money on your balance sheet tends to accelerate the deal flow, because people recognise you have money and they come to see you to talk to you about things. So, you know, we've always deployed money pretty quickly. I think on average we deployed 75% of proceeds in sort of six-ish months, something of that ilk. And again, you know, we're being pretty quick on the deployment here, but, you know, the key is making sure that the criteria that we invest to and the quality of the deal flow that we are investing in still remains extremely strong. That is the lifeblood of Chrysalis, is making sure we get those investments right. So we have a lot of money. We have deployed quite a bit of it. We did have quite a decent pipeline beforehand. But the kind of key message I want to get across to the listeners is that, you know, at no point will we be compromising on our thresholds of quality, if you like, just to deploy money.
Quite a lot of people worry that valuations in late stage ventures are quite frothy at the moment. There was a recent Money Week article saying that the prospect of early flotations may be encouraging crossover investors to overpay and encourage overconfidence. Do you worry that you might have overpaid for any of your holdings?
No, is the short answer. Oh, look, it's always the case. I mean, through my entire investing career, you know, I've been doing this for over 20 years. There are always stocks that are overvalued, and likewise, there are lots of stocks that are undervalued. And, you know, our job, quite simply, is to not overpay for anything. And I know it sounds quite, you know, kind of trite, but ultimately, that's what we're here to do. And you know, there's a lot of wonderful opportunities out there where valuation isn't the most important consideration, you know, where entrepreneurs and founders are looking for partnerships. And, you know, we are trying to position ourselves, you know, in those opportunities where, you know, these entrepreneurs and founders recognize the benefits of having a long-term supportive partner such as ourselves. So it isn't all about valuation. And yeah, you know, I agree there are lots of valuations out there that are very full, are very expensive. But then I suppose if you look at our portfolio, this is one of the reasons why we pull the numbers out. But, you know, if you look at, you know, Klarna is a great example, you know, for most of the period of ownership that we've owned Klarna, it was valued on 7 to 8 times forward EV to sales multiple, where the listed peer group was on about 20. The recent funding round that uplifted the valuation to $45 billion valued the business on about 13 times forward EV to sales, so still at a big discount. If you look at WeFox, trades at a huge discount versus the most obvious listed peers. If you look at Starling Bank, again, we've given, you know, we pulled all of these numbers out, but Starling Bank is a bank that's capable of generating significant profits in the hundreds of millions of pounds, given the size of its balance sheet today. And that was last valued at £1.3 billion. And so again, I think if you look at the portfolio that we've got, I actually think it looks attractively valued versus listed peers. The one difference, or the key difference really, is the rate of growth. And, you know, on a blended basis, revenue growth across the portfolio is just under 80%. So 80. That is much, much faster than listed markets and listed peers. So I think what I suppose I'm saying is that we've got a very, very fast growing portfolio where the valuations of most of the major assets, you know, in the portfolio are at discounts to listed peers. And, you know, we've, you know, publicly disclosed that information. So yeah, look, I think we feel pretty good about our portfolio.
Right, and I think the other point of that is that we always value and we always benchmark against our listed market experience. So it's not a bootstrapping exercise for us where, you know, one venture capitalist pays 100 and the next one pays 200 or what have you, and it sort of moves up in a bootstrap example. For us, it's about looking at the characteristics of each individual investment and using our experience, saying, well, if this was listed in the market, what would it be valued at? And applying that to the entry price such that we feel comfortable that as we go towards an exit, we're going to be on the right side of market multiples.
Just to clarify for listeners, the NAV's published quarterly, and that can be part of the reason why the premium and discount can vary quite significantly from the NAV. Is there anything that would you hope to publish the NAV more frequently? If you can compare it with listed peers, would that be something you might try to do?
I think it's something that we've explored, Mary. We publish the NAV every 3 months. And the reality is that, you know, the process, so typically it takes companies about a month to prepare the financial statements that you would, you know, use in your valuation process. So let's just say, for example, it's a June quarter end. So you would typically get the financial statements, you know, towards the end of June, maybe at the beginning of July. You'd then have to send all of that data off to the external valuer, and we use IHS Market. And then they would then obviously turn, you know, their valuation process around, and that has a time lag of 2 to 3 weeks. So by the time all of that happens, you know, it can take up to 2 months. So typically we publish, you know, around 2 months after the period end. You can make it quicker. There are ways of making it quicker. So do you have to use, say, the June financials? Could you use the May financials, but with June period end comparable multiples, and make adjustments here and there if something specific has happened in that last month of a period? Yes, look, Mary, I suppose for us, I think, you know, we are looking at ways of making it quicker. We haven't decided anything, but it can be done more quickly, but there is a reason for the delay. It's not because we don't want to get it out more quickly. You just have to follow a process. I would say, though, you know, coming back to the NAV, you know, it is important that to understand that there is a delay. So the NAV that is out there today, you know, that's March the 35th NAV, you know, the 206p or so. And since that, you know, since that point in time, we've had a significant valuation uplift in Klarna, which was announced in June. And then obviously we've had the recent IPO of Wise, and we put statements out on both of those. So, you know, Klarna, we said that the gross uplift, if the valuer values it at that funding round, would be around 20p a share. And then we said with Wise that at the March period end, we had an 8% of the portfolio invested in Wise. at a valuation of 511p a share, and I think the share price today is somewhere in the region of 970-980p. So again, you know, the share price there is significantly higher than the carrying value in that Marsh NAV.
Klarna is your biggest holding by a significant amount, and is, as you said, 45 billion. It's a big company. How involved do you get with management of your holdings? And is there a risk of ever feeling powerless, maybe the wrong word, but dwarfed by big private equity partners calling the shots?
Well, I mean, yeah, I think the honest answer to that is that it is slightly horses for courses. And in certain companies, if you take Graphcore, for example, which are designing a new type of microprocessor to be used with for artificial intelligence applications, deep learning, etc., I have to say, you know, Richard and I's kind of skill set does not lie in helping them to develop a microprocessor. Whereas if you take companies like Starling, etc., which is in banking, and, you know, Richard and I have invested in our public funds in banks for, you know, for years, we have a good understanding of maybe the ecosystem within the UK and the kinds of attributes that investors value highly within those types of financial assets. And so our ability to help companies like Starling to navigate strategically towards the optimum solution for potentially a listing or whatever in the fullness of time is much higher. So the honest answer to your question is that in certain businesses, we are much more actively involved at a strategic level on board than others. You know, nearly all of the businesses that we operate or partner with, we have either, you know, the ability to appoint board members or are board observers on them. You know, certain companies, obviously, you can offer more, you know, strategically than others because of your skill set. But it is really a question of horses for courses. And when we go into investments, we look at the structure of the share capital table. We understand our position within that. We also understand the positioning of the unit within Chrysalis Investments itself in terms of the risk that we're taking. All of those attributes and points go into the mix in terms of deciding whether we invest or not, what the valuation is. Do we feel comfortable with our position in the share capital table? Do we feel we have enough influence on the board to achieve the agenda we might want, whether it's kind of an ESG angle we want to push or more strategically with the company as a whole? So all of that goes into the mix. And the honest answer is that it depends on, you know, depending on which type of company we're looking at. But I think for a number of our companies, we are pretty active with them. And I think they value the opinion that we have, particularly because it tends to come with a public market angle, which ultimately most of them are looking to, you know, to try and list.
Do you ever worry that given the IPO market is quite hot at the moment, that some companies might risk listing too early in their development?
No, not really, because I think, you know, again, at that particular point, we are usually quite vocal and have quite a weighty voice at that point in the proceedings. You know, and I think most entrepreneurs recognise the right time to float their businesses. There can be pressure on them to float earlier, and that pressure typically comes from venture capitalists or maybe private equity companies operating as a minority investor. So when we say private equity, obviously the you know, majority buyout is the typical private equity structure, but a number of them have recognised that, you know, businesses like Klarna, for example, if they want to get involved with them, they'll have to accept a minority position. And as those units have got bigger and bigger, and as companies have typically stayed private for longer, so those units have an opportunity to become bigger. Yes, there becomes sometimes a drive by certain investors to push for exit. You know, Chrysalis is set up to make it agnostic between private and public ownership, specifically for that reason. But pressure can mount. And I think, you know, it is an ongoing debate that we can have at board. And again, as I say, I think, you know, we have strong voices at that point about the right time to float. But in the businesses that we're invested in, you know, we've not really been exposed to that type of scenario occurring. I think it's because of our understanding of where the investment case is, and it's ensuring alignment with the executive team of the company you're investing in and other investors at point of our investment, such that we all have a pretty clear view as to the likely path, you know, of development of the company.
That's a good point. How often is the next stage of development priced in, Richard? Just because I noticed when Lloyds announced that they had bought Embark Group, that that you'd put out a statement saying that that wouldn't affect the NAV. Is that often the next stage is sort of priced into to what you're buying?
It depends, really, I suppose, is the answer. So something like an embark, as we said, we've had sight of that transaction for a number of months, really. So, so that was taken into account. Elsewhere, it depends, I suppose, is the answer. So, the valuation methodology typically is backward-looking. So kind of, trading 12-month financials, trading 12-month, valuation metrics. And then, of course, it does lead to, certain situations. Well, what if you've got a company that's done some M&A? And could that M&A be transformational? And the answer is, well, it could. And it would then tend to feed into the valuation through time as the benefit of, say, that M&A started to filter in. So I think it's part of the reason when you actually look at Chrysalis, when we've had valuation uplifts, names like Klarna and names like Wise, a lot of it does reflect the fact that the valuation methodology is typically backward looking. And, the reality is pretty much all investors, are not really interested in what happened last year. They're more interested in what's going to happen next year, the year after, and the years beyond that. So I would say that the valuation methodology for that reason is pretty conservative.
And you might have some tailwinds from the levers the government's been trying to pull recently. We've had the Hill Review, where they're sort of talking about relaxing listing rules, and the investment big bang to encourage investment in private, longer-term assets. You released a statement saying you'd been engaging with them on that. Just wondering what your thoughts are and what the substance of those engagements are.
As a very active market participant in the IPO space, in the listed market, we feel strongly and have felt strongly that we want to have as vibrant as an IPO market as possible in the UK. I think it's the lifeblood of the market. And particularly, both of us, well, Richard still runs his, listed fund. I handed over the reins earlier this year of mine to focus on Chrysalis. IPO rejuvenates the market, and the UK market, the wider market, there is a lot of, I wouldn't want to say legacy business, but kind of traditional business of big miners and big oil companies and big mobile telcos and bits and pieces, which are not maybe as dynamic and growing as quickly as some of the younger businesses, which typically haven't, not all of them have listed yet. Trying to encourage those types of businesses to list in London and give UK investors the opportunity to invest in them, I think we feel very strongly about, and I think when we look at things like, so there's pros and cons to dual class listings, some certain golden shares in certain points. But I think for us, it's about ensuring that entrepreneurs feel comfortable listing their businesses there and equally respecting corporate governance such that these things do have, for example, golden share, THG had one, that is time limited such that that protection falls away within 3 years, so that you can have, I don't want to use a Borisism, but you can sort of slightly have your cake and eat it at the same time. But making the UK market attractive is definitely going to be of benefit to the wider, UK investor. And to that extent, we participated, or Richard participated in the Hill Review. We have been discussing with government some of their views about, particularly around listing and what should and shouldn't go ahead. The wider UK government policy drive is to try to persuade more investors to look at what they call long-term assets, which effectively are illiquid assets, so such that the ones that the Chrysalis are invested in, because I think government is recognising the fact that the majority of the investment that's gone into these types of businesses has been from outside the UK. So very, very active venture capital market, obviously in places like Silicon Valley, a lot of that money is now looking at further afield. And, it, just because you've got a great business in the UK doesn't mean it won't be very big in the US as well. So a lot of these companies have moved overseas to look for opportunities outside America. And so the funding for a lot of British startups has come often from outside the UK. And I think the government is keen to try and keep that onshore, if you like. So, we're not waving the sort of jingoistic flag too aggressively, but I think, we agree. And I think Chrysalis, not only to be pushed the crossover angle, but I think the form of Chrysalis is really important, because that gives individual investors, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, an opportunity to buy shares in Chrysalis And Chrysalis has the key to unlock some of these investments in big companies. It allowed Mr. and Mrs. Smith to own a bit of Starling Bank or a bit of Wise before it was listed, or, you know, a bit of Feature Space. And these are assets, you know, unless you're very privileged and have a family office with millions of pounds being run for you, it's very, very hard to get into these types of investment. And so being able to open up and offer these investments is what Chrysalis is all about. And I think what the government is looking at now is trying to make it easier for people to invest in these asset classes, you know, more widely. And I think, you know, generally, we are pretty supportive of that. We think it's fair.
Richard, do you have any tips for investors on how you could spot if an IPO is going to do well or not?
Oh, yeah, I think for us, you know, the IPOs that over the years have done very, very well for us, mids and smalls, you know, we want to invest in companies that are growing quickly, that have the capacity to continue to grow strongly. What you find or tend to find with the stock market is, you know, it always fades the rate of growth too quickly. So you need to find businesses that have, you know, some kind of sustainable competitive advantage, whether it's, you know, their unit economics or whether it's the IP around their product or service, but something that gives a sustainable competitive advantage that allows a business to carry on growing more quickly than people anticipate or expect. And typically when we've invested successfully, you know, through IPOs and private businesses, it's the sustained rate of growth that has really driven outsized investment returns. So, yeah, and we've seen it years ago. I always remember looking at, you know, Rightmove years ago when we invested in that business at IPO, exactly the same. You know, the market didn't back the sustainability of the growth, and it was that sustainability of the growth that really drove, you know, the share price. So, you know, that's probably the key characteristic I would say, you know, to look out for.
Now, I want to ask some specific questions about companies. We've mentioned Klarna quite a lot. It's a buy now, pay later app, and it's now the biggest private fintech company in Europe. Critics allege that these schemes can encourage overspending and can potentially damage customers' credit histories if they fail to keep up on payments. Some see comparisons with payday lenders. What are your thoughts on this? Like, how many people are struggling to repay, and what are your answer to people that criticise the business model?
Yeah, I think so. Firstly, so stepping back, really, and I think if you look at what the proposition is with Klarna, so it's this three kind of product areas. You know, you can pay now, which obviously doesn't involve any kind of credit. Pay later, which is typically pay in 30 days, and then the third area is pay installments. Typically, is paying in 3 to 4 installments. Pay later, which is a very popular product, is interest free. So I would say, in terms of proposition, you know, nothing like, you know, payday lenders where, oh God, you know, the annual rate of the APR was astronomical. So it's a merchant funded solution. You know, someone's paying, but it's not the consumer. So why is it attractive? It's when you think about what the proposition is, you know, before buy now, pay later, the consumer would pay for a product, very often send it back, and then obviously their money was tied up for 2 or 3 weeks while a refund was processed. So I would say, in terms of, you know, what Klarna is doing, or buy now, pay later is doing, is actually solving a very real problem for many people, is that, you know, many people with, I suppose, lower incomes couldn't afford to have their money tied up for 2 to 3 weeks. So I think there's a big sort of, you know, social value really to what the product is doing. The fact it's interest-free and it's merchant-funded. So again, you know, it's very, very cost-effective. When we looked at Klarna specifically, I think this really comes down to, you know, suitability and affordability. You know, when you're extending credit effectively to customers, you know, are you doing it in a, you know, ethical, sustainable way? And at the end of the day, you know, Nick and I, over our careers, we've invested in lots of lending businesses, and there's nothing wrong with credit. I think we've got to be clear on that. But it has to be extended in a, you know, ethical and sustainable manner. And when we looked at Klarna, that was a big emphasis in our due diligence process. So if you go back to 2013, on an index basis, Klarna's late payment fees, so this is people miss payments, they declined by 83%. Now, the flip side of that, of course, is that Klarna, for a period of time, grew more slowly than many other buy now, pay later businesses. And that was absolutely fine by us, because we felt that the growth that Klarna was delivering was certainly sustainable and done in an ethical way. So, look, I think I got to kind of, you know, caution against that. You know, people just, you know, shouldn't necessarily view, just because it's a different form of finance, you know, shouldn't view it as something that is, you know, improper or not being done properly, or, you know, whatever the phrase is. You know, lending's been around obviously thousands of years, and it just needs to be done in a proper, sustainable, ethical manner, which we think it is for Klarna.
Point on that bit as well is, if you think about what the alternative is to Klarna, you'd be using a credit card, which is another whole model, which is, no one would have any issue with credit cards, would they? But if you think about the credit card model, particularly if you're younger, you know, your APR is probably 40% to start with. And the people who fund the credit card companies, the people who can't pay, who, let's face it, most people probably roll their credit card and pay it off every month. And so the credit card model is founded on the basis that the people less able to pay are the ones who are funding everybody else. And the Klarna model is funded on the basis where the merchant is socialising the credit cost across all consumers. And so if you think about it on that way, actually socially, the way in which Klarna is approaching the whole idea of credit has got to be fairer than the credit card companies. And weirdly, well, not weirdly at all really, but most of the vocal noises is coming from the credit card companies, because they look at this and think, oh my goodness, this is a big issue for our business here, because there's a better model which is being put into place and into play. And so there's a lot of attack going on about it, because they are very, very defensive about their current business model. But that's just a view, but it feels like a fair view to me.
And Starling Bank, your next biggest holding, how do you view the investment case of Starling Bank compared with rivals Monzo and Revolut?
Back in the day when we did Starling, when I say back in the day, it's only a couple of years ago, but it feels like a long time in fintech. A couple of years ago when we did the Starling investment, you know, we had met Tom at Monzo a couple of times, who, let's face it, built a fabulous model. And, you know, I wouldn't want to denigrate Monzo.
But he worked at Starling Bank, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Yeah. You know, initially, yeah, they worked together. And that's a whole different story, one of which I probably should not go into at this point. You can read Anne's book if you want on that. But Anne Bowden, who's the CEO of Starling. But yes, no, so Tom had started a business which did extremely well virally in capturing particularly young people, but just new customers. And it had built itself very, very rapidly, very, very quickly into something like 5 million customers. When we met Starling, they only had 200,000 customers and a deposit base of £200 million. So it was actually really very, very small in the grand scheme of things. And I think when we met the two, and actually it was talked about in the FT at the weekend, what was very clear was that one was run by a very enterprising entrepreneur. The other was run by, well, again, another good entrepreneur, but one with a lot of banking experience. And so when you talked through the Starling model, it was in terms that we understood as bank investors, in terms of tier one ratios, in terms of, you know, risk-weighted assets, all these sorts of things. So we could see a very clear way, when you look at the unit economics of Starling, which did have a slightly different demographic and thus a higher unit economic potential, we could see a very clear route to how you'd monetize that business and bring it to profitability. Whereas I think Monzo, to be fair, at that point in time was all just about growing. And it was slightly like, when we got loads of customers, we'll then sort of work out how to monetize that customer base. And I think if you read an article by Tom a year or two ago, when he was just beginning to sort of leave Monzo and talking about how profit had become a dirty word within Monzo, that's an issue, because, you know, for us, it's right to have profit in a business, because profit makes the business sustainable. And the difficulty with an unsustainable business, particularly in banking, where there's a lot of regulatory capital required, is that pressure builds up from either it to be plugged via investors or by profit, so you can plug the capital. And of course, that's what's happened to Monzo. Whereas Starling, I think, having come at it from a much more banking angle, although it was seen as the slight ugly duckling, dare I say it, I hope Anne's not listening to this, initially, I think the unit economics of that business have shone through. And as it's begun to scale and it's grown very, very quickly, you know, we now sit here with a couple of million customers and over 6 billion of deposits 2 years later. Those unit economics have really kicked in, and such that, you know, you've seen the bank move into significant profitability, and it has been profitable for, you know, every month, I think, since October last year. I think initially those are the differences that we pulled out, and that was the reason we went with Starling. Is Starling better than Monzo? I don't know if your listeners can decide about that. We've obviously stuck our flag in one corner and have been very active and supporters of the business, particularly through the last year, which has been pretty difficult for most people, including bankers, dare I say it, to help them grow that business very successfully. And I think it's, you know, to Richard's point earlier in the podcast, you know, as we sit here today, you've got a business which is profitable with a loan to deposit ratio of only 37%, give or take. Most banks operate at 100%. So if you're profitable already, having only lent out 37% of your deposits, if you can get out the rest of the, you know, 63% out to market and loans, how profitable that bank be? Well, we think would be extremely profitable. And that's why really we went with Starling. So, you know, for our money, obviously Starling is the one that we think is going to be successful and the one that we preferred at that point.
Starling is the darling.
Starling is the darling.
Richard, Wise, formerly TransferWise, recently listed, is another company that I'm sure listeners will be interested to hear about. I noticed last year they had filed to be able to offer investment services and said it would be within the next 12 months. Is that something that's coming up? And what do you think about the outlook for Wise more broadly?
Well, this is it, you see. And again, like, if you think about your business like Revolut, you know, why was Revolut valued at $30 billion or $33 billion? You know, it's this concept of super apps. You know, these are apps that have millions of customers, you know, globally, and are still only scratching the surface in terms of market share of the industries that they are disrupting. And the concept of a super app is that effectively, you know, once you have those customers, you can offer them more services. You know, so look, I can't comment too specifically on Wise, but you know, the reality is they've got a very loyal, fast-growing customer base globally. And this is a business that is built, you know, the whole culture of the company is disruption and actually offering customers a great service at a very low cost. Part of the reason when you think about valuations in this area is why these companies command, you know, massive valuations. Because if you look at what Wise are doing, I think in the retail market, their market share, I think it's probably less than 2%, you know, globally, where they are charging on average 60 basis points fees, 0.6% fee. Whereas if you transferred money abroad using one of the high street banks, you know, by the time you pay a fixed fee and you get, you know, you get an exchange rate that obviously isn't the spot rate, you know, so there's a embedded fee built into that exchange rate as well. You know, the fee from a bank could be anywhere between 3-7%. So, you know, that's 0.6% is massively more compelling. And you also get great service because 35% of money that's transferred anywhere around the world is instantaneous, where it could take days for your bank. You can offer that kind of service proposition in lots of other verticals as well. So, yeah, you know, and obviously people recognize this. So that's why these businesses trade at big valuation multiples. It's almost the option value of what, you know, what can they do next? Yeah, so I'd say for Wise, you know, it's a great example of why we wanted to invest in private companies. When we first invested in, well, what was called TransferWise back then was in November 2017. And, you know, I can say it now because it's public, but we invested in a business, you know, the business then at a valuation of $1.665 billion.
But you're not going to tell me when I'm going to be able to buy Chrysalis on Wise. Another company that's come to market quite recently, or towards the end of last year, was the Hut Group, which is quite interesting. There was lots of excitement around it and the share price went up, and it looks like now it's come back down again to around its float price. What's gone on there, and what's your outlook for the company?
Yeah, I think, you know, look, I suppose the trite answer to that is that nothing always goes up in, you know, markets don't always go up in a straight line. And I think, you know, to Rich's comments earlier, that I think, you know, sometimes markets can be a bit short-sighted in terms of the longevity of growth and the runway that it affords. So, you know, for the Hut Group particularly, you know, we were delighted when they listed it, you know, at 500p. That represented a very, very good return for us on our initial investment. We're at 600p now, which is an even better return on our investment. Yes, it did touch nearly 800p, and it's tracked back a bit. But, you know, for us, again, you know, we have the option to retain listed equity once they float from our portfolio, or we can sell it. And, you know, we did sell a little bit back end of last year when the shares went up to, getting towards those highs. We actually bought a bit back when they made their recent acquisitions and share placing. You know, for us, this is a journey where we see considerable upside from the rollout of Ingenuity to new customers, and also significant upside from the M&A opportunities surrounding beauty and nutrition. So, you know, our hope and our expectation is that, you know, the shares will continue to perform well over, you know, a multiple period. And if we feel that that is not the case, then, you know, we obviously wouldn't be holding them within the portfolio at the moment. So, you know, sometimes it takes a bit of time to get where you want to go to. And, you know, we still feel comfortable that we're on that right track.
Great. Well, thank you so much for coming on. I'm afraid that's all we've got time for, but I really appreciate your time. It's really interesting.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks for having us. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.